The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network. Greetings, scribes. I have got some exciting news to share. The Writer Files now has an exclusive Patreon community where subscribers will get exclusive access to uncut ad-free interviews, a writer's happy hour, bonus breakdowns, and content from productivity and publishing experts each month. In the meantime, just head over to patreon.com/thewriterfiles. It's free to join Patreon to get a preview, and you can upgrade anytime. That's patreon.com/thewriterfiles. Help us start something special.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Rainmaker FM.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am your host, Kelton Reed, here to take you on another tour of the habits, habitats, and brains of renowned writers. And this week, award-winning podcast host, managing editor of WNYC Studios Note to Self, and author of Bored and Brilliant, How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self, Manoush Zomorodi took a moment from her hectic schedule to rap with me about her claim to fame as a podcaster, the neuroscience of boredom, and how to recharge your creative batteries. Manoush is a former globe-trotting journalist and producer for both BBC and Reuters. She's won 4 New York Press Club Awards for her work with New York Public Radio and was named 2017's Best Tech Podcast by the Academy of Podcasters. Her podcast is described as a tech show that searches for answers to life's digital quandaries through experiments and conversations with listeners and experts. Her first book, Bored and Brilliant, is grounded in both neuroscience and cognitive psychology and based on a groundbreaking experiment she conducted with thousands of her podcast listeners to help them unplug from their devices, get bored, and jumpstart their creativity. In addition to her popular TED Talk, How Boredom Can Lead to Your Most Brilliant Ideas, she's appeared on NBC Nightly News, MSNBC, The Dr. Oz Show, and she contributes to NPR, Quartz, Inc., and Radiolab. In this file, Manoush and I discuss the miracle of technology and its inherent ills, why our favorite algorithms are programmed to distract us, how the author enlisted thousands of podcast listeners for her one-of-a-kind experiment, why you need to change your digital habits to be more creative, the undeniable power of deadlines, and why you need to beware of technology that claims to solve your problems with more technology. The Writer Files is brought to you by the all-new Studio Press Sites, a turnkey solution that combines the ease of an all-in-one website builder with the flexible power of WordPress. It's perfect for authors, bloggers, podcasters, and affiliate marketers, as well as those selling physical products, digital downloads, and membership programs. If you're ready to take your WordPress site to the next level, see for yourself why over 200,000 website owners trust Studio Press. Go to rainmaker.fm/studiopress now. That's rainmaker.fm/studiopress. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click subscribe to automatically see new interviews as soon as they're published. All right. We are rolling once again with a very special guest today. I have WNYC's Note to Self podcast host and managing editor, author, journalist, seeker of relentless information on the modern human condition. Thanks so much for hopping on here, Manoush Zomorodi. I hope I am pronouncing that correctly.
You did just fine, Kelton Reed. Thank you.
Awesome, awesome. Well, every week on your podcast, you're questioning the human condition. It's a tech show about being more human. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's more like, you know, we've always had a hard time describing like what the show actually is, but I feel like all the headlines that you're seeing about Facebook and Twitter and Google and people starting to question the outsized role that these tech companies have in our lives, that's what we've kind of been doing all along. So I feel like, yay, our moment is here. Yeah. It's really sort of every week understanding how this stuff gets built, what sort of repercussions it has. Because I think for me, it was this sort of moment that I had where I was like, oh man, like it's not just like what app you're going to use. It's like technology was transforming and like really quickly how we found love, how we parented, the work that we do. I mean, the fact that you and I are taping this, you know, and we're in two different cities, and I don't know about you, but I'm like in a hotel room and doesn't matter, you know, it's very, very cool. And it all, I think we forget that like 5 years ago, the world was really different.
Yeah, I know. It's very interesting that your show has been talking about these things. And how long has the show been on the air now?
It's been, 4 years, 4 years since 2013, around there. Yep.
Yeah. And so much has changed. It's like this just amazing. I mean, we're just overwhelmed with stuff, right? Daily updates and new tech. And it's just like exponential, right?
Yeah. I feel like there's just our to-do list are so long between like making sure you're running the right software to making sure you're, you know, refreshing the headlines because who knows what's happened. And I think the question is though, what happens to some of the stuff that we're doing in real life, so to speak?
Yep.
But also like, how do we begin to sort of take back managing all this? I think the bloom is off the rose, so to speak. There was this real sort of, you know, move fast and break things was Facebook's mantra. Don't do evil was Google's mantra. There was this, you know, they were coming, the tech companies were coming to make everything better. And now we're at the point where we realize, oh no, there are humans behind all this technology. And when there are humans, that means that algorithms get programmed with human bias. And the internet isn't just for sharing art and wonderful ideas on blogs. It's also for sharing hate, unfortunately. So, you know, it's technology is so not binary. It's not good or bad. There's so many shades of gray. And I think that's where the interesting stories are to me. And that's why podcasting was like the perfect place to sort of explore, tell people's personal stories about how technology was changing their lives, understand what sort of difference it was making, and then try to figure out like how to use it better so we get more of the good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have won numerous awards, including a handful from the New York Press Club. You've been featured on NBC Nightly News. You've been a contributor to NPR Radio Lab, lots of cool stuff. And on your podcast, you kind of started doing experiments with listeners. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think, I think you're talking about the first one, which was called Bored and Brilliant, which happened in 2015.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was it was like one of my personal sort of moments where I was like, I was having, it wasn't writer's block, Kelton. It was like different than writer's block. It was like there was sand in my brain. Like I couldn't figure out what was going on. I was definitely like a creative, I don't even know what, not a block. It was like everything had solidified. And I was like, what is my problem? Why am I having so much trouble coming up with good ideas? And it started to sort of dawn on me that maybe it was because all the little cracks in my day, you know, when I used to be waiting in line for coffee and just sort of spacing out, thinking about things, I was now like shoving information into my brain. I was looking at my phone and it sort of occurred to me that I had not been bored since like basically 2009. And so this was me thinking like, whoa, is that a good thing that I haven't been bored? People tell us it's good, that boredom is a bad thing, that we should avoid it at all costs. But could this be the reason why my brain is feeling as stuck as it is? And if I changed my smartphone habits, would that make a difference? And so my lovely podcast listeners, I was asked them, I was like, would you be willing to like play along like with an experiment where every day we just try something different with our smartphone and see what happened? And I thought like a couple hundred people would sign up to do it with me. And 20,000 people signed up in the first 48 hours. And I was like, oh, this is a thing. Like people are feeling this. They are feeling as though their technology has turned into more of a taskmaster than the tool it is really supposed to be, a tool that improves our lives. So for 1 week, every day, these 20,000 people would wake up and they'd get a mini podcast that explained the neuroscience between how we, what boredom actually does to our brain, what happens in our brain, some of the design of the technology that it hijacks that attention of ours. And then they'd get a newsletter with a behavior tweak to try that day. And then they would report back. And And it turns out that when you get bored, you know, this was, I had no idea that we're at this incredible moment in neuroscience where we're starting to understand what happens in our minds when we allow it to wander. And it's, we ignite a network in our brains called the default mode. And in the default mode, this is when you do your most original thinking. It's when you problem solve. It's when you do something that I had never heard of called autobiographical planning. This is where you look back at your life, you take note of the highs and the lows, and you build a personal narrative, and then you look forward and you set goals way into the future. It's called perspective bias in psychology speak. And then you set, you know, figure out, how am I going to reach those goals? So like super important stuff happens in the default mode, but you can't tap that brain power if you're always tapping your screen. So this was this, you know, 20,000 people who experimented and tried to spend a little less time on their phones, and it actually worked. Like, we had some incredible breakthroughs. And as a consequence, the book version of the project just came out a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a great book, truly amazing book. And I think creatives, you know, should seek it out. I mean, anybody could benefit from this. Obviously, we're kind of all dealing with this technology overload, but
it is really hard. Like, I went on a 12 city book tour, and I feel like that is, people are really struggling. You know, the other theme that keeps coming up when I was talking to people is workplace burnout. Just the, you know, Slack is great, and also a huge burden, just the pinging, the nonstop pinging that people feel like they're having a hard time doing the deeper creative work.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, a handful of other great authors have tackled this. I know, I'm sure you've spoken to or about Irresistible. I think that was Adam Alter's book about the, you know, kind of the addictive nature of technology as we know it right now. And Cal Newport has talked about, you know, kind of deep
it's great
flow stuff, and you know, it's kind of, it seems like it's on everybody's mind. You know, I've spoken with a neuroscientist on this show about kind of the same ideas about creativity and you know, kind of how we can better tap into that. But this speaks directly to that for me. The book itself, Bored and Brilliant, How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self, it's a fantastic look at why these things are important, kind of the neuroscience of boredom and building on that experiment that you did, but it's grounded in that great neuroscience and cognitive psychology piece. So kudos on the work. It's a fantastic book.
Yeah. I mean, I'm grateful to my listeners, because really their very personal experiences are peppered throughout the book. I'm going to claim the title of first crowdsourced podcast project turned into a book. So I hope that's okay that I claim that title. I know, right? I'm super grateful to my listeners, because they are the reason, you know, their stories and their feedback. I mean, we partnered with apps that people used, which is kind of funny and ironic, yes. But like Measure. So we have we had a data set that we were able to sort of, you know, really look and see which behavior tweaks made the biggest difference to people's creativity and problem solving. And then they also really reported back with extremely personal stories, like this guy, Liam. He's an actor in Los Angeles, and he, one of the challenges that we asked people to do was delete an app off their phone. And Liam, I love him. He's such an extremist. He deleted every single social media app off his phone.
Wow.
And we just asked people to do it for a day. Like, we were like, you know, just for a day, see what it's like not to have the notifications and the itchy thumb to check these things. And 2 years later, he got back in touch, and he said that he never put them back on his phone, the apps like Twitter, Facebook, all the rest of them. And that, because he just felt that he liked his life better, and actually he liked himself better without those apps constantly calling out to him, to sort of his, you know, his superego, I guess, like, post here, don't you want to see like the amazing lives that everybody else is having? Is yours, you know, good enough? He was like, I don't need this. So now, you know, for him, this is what worked. He doesn't have them on his phone. Yes, he's still on these platforms, but he does it purposefully. He sits down at a computer, he does his 20 minutes, and then he logs off. And that works for him. But I think, you know, we heard from some people who they liked the feeling for a day and that was enough for them. It just was a nice reminder that they have control over these platforms. And for other people, you know, it depends on your personality. For some people, it was like, whoa, this has been eating up my brain power. I don't want this. And Brooke Gladstone, the host of On the Media, deleted Facebook after reading my book, which I thought was kind of crazy.
That's amazing.
She got off the platform. She killed her profile. I was like, you know, Brooke, that wasn't my intention. Like, it's not that I'm saying like, these things are terrible. Cause I think they can be really wonderful. I love my phone, but she was like, nope, I read the science, done.
Wow. Yeah.
So yeah.
And just a quick aside to revisit the exclusive Writer Files Patreon community, where subscribers get access to uncut ad-free interviews, a writer's happy hour, bonus breakdowns, and a lot more. I know that for serious writers, it can be more distracting than ever to cut through the noise, stay productive, and home in on what's happening in the publishing industry. Over 8 years, we've provided a looking glass into the habits of professional writers and publishing industry insiders. And as your humble host, I've decided to launch a membership-based Patreon for serious scribes to cut through the noise, swap tips and tricks, and hang out with like-minded peers. Just head over to patreon.com/thewriterfiles for bonus writing resources, monthly episode breakdowns, writer's happy hour, a community of your peers, ad-free episodes, and more. It's free to join to get a preview, and you can upgrade anytime. That's patreon.com/thewriterfiles. Help us start something cool and special. Keep calm and write on.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah. So, I mean, this constant need for our attention that technology demands is draining our brains of that ability to create. And this great system that you set up, or these practical steps, rather, to kind of quell the cult of busyness that we have are great. And there's 7 steps, right?
Yes.
For changing your digital habits. And so listeners, find the book, Bored and Brilliant. It is really fantastic. And your website, ManushZ.com, I believe, has all that information about the podcast, the book, kind of some other suggestions for the podcast and a lot of great information there. So I will link to that, of course. But I really want to get into your process as a writer, because my guess is that you had to put a lot of these into practice to sit down. And we talked about this earlier, how writing a book can be kind of boring. And surely you had to put a lot of these to use to get all of these words together from the podcast and all of these different experts and case studies and all that. So let's talk about how you did it.
Yeah.
So you're not only...
Well, this was new for me.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that.
So yeah. This is your first book, your first nonfiction book. And so you had to... I mean, you've got a full-time job, you've got kids, you've got a life. How did you manage to schedule the time to read, research, and then start to get all of the pieces together for this fantastic book?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, I started with a base of information, like the fact that I was basing the book on a project that I had done so much research for and so many interviews for and had gotten so many stories that, like, that part, I felt like I wasn't like climbing into the abyss that I imagine many authors are, that are like, have, you know, starting from scratch. Like, I had already come up with this stuff and I already kind of, I knew what I wanted the book to be. So that, I think, you know, was good. And then it was just getting my butt in a chair and filling in the holes and doing the hard part, which I find I can, you know, for me, Kelton, like, I've been a broadcast journalist for like 20 years now. So writing for radio or writing for video or TV, that comes very easily to me. But writing text is quite difficult. And I found it, you know, it very tiring, very draining, as I'm sure some of your listeners know all too well, that like I could only really do a couple pages at once, but I'm not the type of person who just sits down and bangs it out. Like, I'm cutting and pasting and putting it together and then moving it around. And there's a lot of like connecting ideas that were not connected in the original project. And also speaking to a new audience, right? Because what I wanted, I didn't want like, oh, I made a book for the podcast listener. Like,
right.
You know, my goal was for people to find the book first and then maybe get interested in listening to the podcast. So, well, one of the things I did was I joined a silent workspace. I don't know if you have those.
And that's a new concept
to me. So it's the Brooklyn Writer Space, and you are not allowed to speak when you are in the writing room. You're not allowed to eat when you're in the writing room. And that's what I need. I needed quiet. I really needed long, like I needed 3 to 4 hours at a stretch of quiet is what I discovered. And that made sense to me because when I write the show, I need 3 to 4 hours solid, like in a row. So that made sense. I was like, okay, so that works for me. I can, you know, in terms of energy, right? Like I can go that long. I'll take breaks and whatever, get a cup of coffee or something. But, that works for me. Like these chunks, which makes sense, you know, according to the science as well. So I was like, all right, I know what works for me. I know how I get my thoughts out, but now you just have to do it in a different form and try not to freak out. And it's not that different. Right. So like, I think what you find though in the book is that it's a very, conversational voice, less academic, simply because I don't know any other way to write.
Yeah. No, it is. It's a great read, and it just kind of pulls you along through different pieces, and it definitely kind of echoes a lot of what's going on with your podcast as well. Mm. So both very accessible, because it does touch on a lot of like high concept. I mean, not everybody knows what an fMRI is, obviously.
Right. not sometimes. Thank you for reminding me. No, like an fMRI. Exactly. And like when you live in the world of public radio, you do start to assume, because like it feels like every other episode of any podcast you listen to made by public radio is about an fMRI or something. But but no, it's it's the ability to see how networks are lighting up in your brain, essentially, with an fMRI. I have been in an fMRI. It is extremely uncomfortable. You have to stay very, very still, and it's like you're being entombed. And that to me was, I think, the challenge of marrying the, you know, kind of hardcore science plus some of the history of boredom, which is fascinating, like the semantics of it, the fact like it didn't even show up on the printed page until Dickens in the mid-1800s, kind of amazing. So some of that, you know, some of the I guess you would say the, like, you know, the oatmeal part, like it's good for you. But then also bringing in my personal experience with all this, plus my listeners' experience with it, plus the data, plus the fact that I'm very into having practical steps and things you can do. I hate it when you read something and they're like, yep, it's a big problem. And I'm always like, yeah, but then what are we supposed to do about it? How do we fix it? So like, I needed it to be all these things that I wanted. And that was the challenge, I think, for me. And so I think organizing it similar to how the podcast series did organized my brain, essentially.
For sure. Yeah, I'm sure that came very handy. So you're sitting in a quiet writing space, no headphones, I'm assuming, and there are other writers there.
Yes.
So do you think there's something also psychological? I know I've read something similar to when you're in a public space and everybody's kind of working and has their eyes on each other, it motivates you to look busy.
Yeah, like I don't think anybody's looking at anybody else, but I am a strong, because they're like carols kind of. So you're, so you could, like, I have walked past people and seen that they're watching crappy YouTube videos. I mean, maybe it's for research. I don't know. Maybe buying those shoes, those booties is for research too. But I think to me, it's very much about, like, you know, there's lots of books about this too. I'm thinking of Charlie Duhigg's book about habits, but like this idea that you associate a place with your best thinking, you know what I mean? So I think it takes a while, but And then when you show up to that place, you're like, oh, this is where I do my best work. And then it just becomes like a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Having said that, I feel like the one thing I did miss was, so this is like hot desks at this workspace that I belong to. Sorry if this is getting way in the weeds. I love talking about co-working spaces. I'm like a little bit obsessed. So I'm a very visual person and I like to have charts and post-it notes and I like to draw timelines and see how things have progressed and all of that. But because, you know, I didn't own the walls, I couldn't leave stuff there. I found that quite difficult. You know, at the end of the day, you pack everything up into your backpack and you go home. I thought a lot about like Virginia Woolf and a room of one's own and how if I, you know, and maybe that's my goal. Like if I have my own sort of writing space where I could leave my shit, just like I like having post-it notes everywhere and visual cues and seeing how things, you know, there's a little bit of a Homeland Carrie Matheson element, like that you're connecting disparate ideas and suddenly you see like what it all means, you know, like I need that. I'm a visual thinker. So I found that very difficult to be stuck inside my laptop and I not being able to switch around between things. My desk at work, I have visual, like I have, oh my God, we have charts and post-it notes and all that sort of stuff, but I can't work it at the radio station. There's just no way. Because radio people love to talk. can't do it.
Yeah. So there is something about separating the two spheres of kind of your brain almost.
I think so. I mean, you know, the way I looked at it, I'm very, well, I have kids too, right? So like I have to be very regimented. So the way I have it now, and I don't know if this is going to change because we're thinking of changing up things at the show, but Mondays and Tuesdays is in the office. Wednesdays is for writing. Thursdays is for interviews and Fridays is for, busy work, like emails and stuff like that. That's how I like, and you know, I've heard that like Jack Dorsey at Twitter does this too. Like each day has like a purpose. And that really works for me because it also works with how I've structured childcare. And, you know, I think if I was a single person, I would relish the flexibility, but since I have, you know, my kids and my husband's and my child caretaker's schedules to all juggle in the freaking school calendar, which kills me, like all of that, do you know what I mean? I have to be very rigid and very disciplined. I mean, that is the hardest part, is the calendar and the scraping out the time and saying to your spouse, like, I know it's Saturday night, dude, I'm sorry, I can't watch Netflix with you. I have to go from 6 to 10 to my writing space because otherwise it's just not gonna happen.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why I could pick up the kids on Wednesday at 3. You know what I mean?
For sure. Well, how do you feel about writer's block? Did you run up against it at all, or is it a thing?
You know, I'm very, very deadline oriented. And I did have a researcher working with me on the book just to sort of help me out in certain spots because I was making the podcast as I was writing the book as well. I didn't take time off. And I think having her, I would always say to her, like, give me a deadline, but when you need that chapter back with the questions I have for you that I need you to find out. Like, so just having, like, I would always say, like, give me a deadline. I'm a journalist. I work really well to deadlines. Mm-hmm. I need a fire under my butt. So, and I think, you know, that I have to say that's the other thing that becoming a parent has been made me much more efficient than I have been in the past. If you are paying the babysitter, you know, $20 an hour, and even if you're just 10 minutes late, you will get it done and you will, you know, you will make it happen. And I would say that the other thing is that's helped me is I think as I've gotten older, you know, I'm sure you've heard this before, that like, I know the first draft is going to suck. Yeah. And the second draft's not going to be very good either, but I have faith in the process. And I know that, and that very much is very meta, which is what the book is about, which this idea that like, we've gotten to a point in our society where, and I see this particularly with some of the young people who've been on the book tour, like they think that they, if they have a thought, then it's not a thought unless it's shared, you know, picks or it didn't happen. But I think that's become actually part of the thought process as well, that the idea of having a thought and not telling someone about it seems very odd. So to tell them like, no, we don't need more opinions in this world. Like, actually what we need is more problem solving. You know, sit on your thoughts, let them germinate. They're probably pretty mediocre. Most thoughts are, and it's not until you've really worked them in some way that maybe they get to a point where they're outstanding and they're worth sharing. You know, I really feel like we've gotten confused. We're mistaking reactivity for productivity. We think that, you know, the constant conversations or checking in or seeing what's going on, we think that's being productive, right? That it's, but really it's being reactive, and being reactive, as we know, is never going to be, you know, you look at the president's Twitter feed, it is never going to be the big solutions. And we need this next generation to be able to do some extremely, God, do we have problems that we need them to come up with original solutions to? So, that has been, for me, just a segue, has been the most rewarding part of this book, is the number of teachers and professors who have said that they're going to, that they're using it in their classrooms. Because, you know, if we can make it fun and interesting, and there's, yes, there's science, but there's also stories, and it's funny, and you, things you can try, like, it's not dry and academic, it's real. And it's about all of us figuring it all out together, because we are living in a one big experiment right now. Every day that we constantly sign terms of service that we don't read, it's just one big experiment, which is exciting, but it also means, like, let's talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I come back to, Einstein's, I think he called it combinatory play.
What's that?
And actually, you know who wrote about it is Maria Popova.
Oh, love her. She's in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, who you mentioned in the book, mm-hmm. Who actually did this. She did this interview in a written format.
Oh, really?
couple, 3 or 4 years ago, I think.
Cool. But she's very strict about what she does. So
yeah.
She'd be flattered.
She wrote about it, but he just said, basically coined the term combinatory play, the essential feature in productive thought before there's any connection with logical construction or words. And he was a big proponent of, you know, just, you know, boredom or whatever, kind of toying with ideas in your mind and taking long, aimless walks, as many great authors have been in the past. But
yes, the walks, totally.
I love it. All such good stuff. Okay. A couple quick questions for you on workflow. Mac or PC?
Mac.
Scrivener or Microsoft Word?
I was doing Google Docs because most podcasts run on Google Docs, but then my researcher was like, what are you doing? If you're publishing, you have to go with Word. So I switched over to Word.
I see.
But I had to when was the last time I purchased something from Microsoft? So I had to buy something from Microsoft, and so that I could see track changes. I was like, what are track changes? Can't we just do Google Docs? No.
Do you have a couple organizational hacks for writers that you rely on?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm obsessed with my to-do list. Obsessed. So Daniel Levitin, the neuroscientist who wrote a book called The Organized Mind, has come on the show. And of course, I sucked him dry for how I should organize my mind. And his whole thing is that with your to-do list, it can't just be a running list. First of all, you have to put every single thing that ever comes into your brain on the list. And then you have to organize them by priority, and you have to schedule them. Sounds tedious, but let me tell you, the amount of brain space that it opens up because you're not trying to remember things is great. So I use an app called, I'm not paid by them or anything. I use Todoist, and I really like it. It works for me. Yeah, I'm a little obsessed with Todoist. Because I know the minute I'm what should I be doing? Look down at Todoist and it has the answer. Yeah. You should be responding to that email. Oh yeah. I mean, I'm just constantly adding stuff, but I know that it's like a big net for all the dumb shit that's going on in my head.
How do you beat procrastination?
Having children.
Uh-huh.
You cannot procrastinate. It's just not allowed. they need to eat dinner. Tough.
Yeah. How does Manoush Z unplug at the end of a hard day?
Well, this is controversial in my world. So as I think it's chapter 5 outlines in my book, the way that I was, let's say, unwinding instead of unplugging was I was playing this game. It's a stupid game. It's very beautiful. It's called Two Dots. It's really, it's like Candy Crush, but like Brooklyn artisanal kind of. And that, like, instead of, you know, having a glass of wine or meditating, like we're all supposed to be doing, I was playing this game. But like to the point where my husband would come in the room and he'd be like, "What you doing?" I'd like throw the phone under the bed and be like, "Oh, just relaxing." Like it was becoming a problem. And so in my world, you can call an expert and get them to figure it like out what's going on. So I spoke to Jane McGonigal. I don't know if you know her. She's an author. You should have her on your show. She's great. She's a futurist at the Institute for the Future, and she's a game designer, and she studies the neurological effects of games on emotion and ambition, and motivation. And so she made me rethink it. She's like, well, the game is obviously serving some sort of purpose to you. And I was like, but what if I'm addicted? She's like, you know, the concept of addiction is going through a radical makeover right now. I don't think you're addicted, if that's the word you want to use. She's like, I think you can set a timer and enjoy what it's giving you, which is a sort of changing of your mindset to go into like, just like bringing it down a notch and not thinking too hard. So now I play my game for about 5 minutes and that's it. And then what do I do? There's nothing I enjoy more than being in bed at like 9 o'clock and reading the New Yorker. I mean, there's just like, that is bliss to me. That is bliss. Especially if the bed's been made and like, you know what I mean? Like you're not getting into like a unmade bed. Like it has to like have been made. My kids are asleep. Like, oh yeah, that is just awesome. My kids are asleep. And the bed is made, like maybe even fresh sheets. And then there's like, you know, there's that New Yorker article and you've already read a couple pages and you're really into it. And they're like 20 more pages to go. And you're like, yes, let's do it. I find that extremely relaxing.
It's funny. I kind of imagined you reading Wired for some reason.
Oh God, no, I can't read about something that I've been thinking about all day because then I'll start coming up with ideas, right? That's like, I have to read articles. I mean, I will read about anything like North Korea, Anthony Bourdain, you name it, but I can't read about tech because then I'm like, oh, we should have done that. Why aren't we doing this? What is that? How does that relate to that? You know? But I do think like what I've seen is I started out as a tech and business reporter. And that's really changed in that technology. Like, I don't even think we're going to be using the word tech or digital in like 5 years. It just is our life, you know? So I love reading. I love like wellness articles. This whole trend in wellness I find really fascinating because I think it really does relate to technology. What we're talking about is our mental health and how we care, you know, getting on Twitter. Do not get on Twitter before bed. I have to, you know, it's hard for me not to, but that's, yeah. So I can't read Wired. No, I love you Wired, but I'll read you during the day.
All right. A couple of questions on creativity. You run up against so many, creative minds in your world. Can you define creativity for us? Kind of your own take on it?
Yeah. So for me, I define it in the book in an extremely unscientific way that it's when you see glitter being sprinkled on your life. What the hell does that mean? So to me, and I saw this with the results of the original Bored and Brilliant project, right? Okay. I think many people, especially when they're listening to a tech show, are like, oh, creativity means you came up with a new idea for a startup that had a 10x, you know, exit return, made all this billions of dollars or whatever, a unicorn, like the very word unicorn sounds like creativity. But what I really saw was that people define creativity in so many different ways, you know, and it could be that you spaced out on the subway and you came up with a amazing way to combine all the weird leftovers that are in your refrigerator into a delicious meal. That is creativity. Or it can be helping, coming up with a way to help your kid make friends at school. That is creativity. It is finding a way to make things a little better in a way that doesn't seem obvious to me. And that really can be very, very small. And I think those little moments of creativity are what sometimes we get it on our phones. Like, you know, if we make something amazing on Instagram and we feel like we've been creative, absolutely. But I think our physical world deserves the same sort of love and attention that sometimes we don't give it as often. I just think of myself, like the amount of time that I spent on Pinterest to understand how to be creative, to make my house look, I mean, like, do you know what I mean? Like, just stop and just be in your house and like, think of, you know what I mean? That I think we're looking to other people, like, what does creativity look like? Whereas it's just, it can be very, very small, you know? So that to me is what creativity is. And it is combining. I think this is maybe the Einstein definition too, combining of two ideas into something new. Just, you know, yeah, there's nothing really original, but it's when you take two things together and smash it and mush it up and make something new. And you don't need to get recognition for it. And I think that that's something that we've lost, is you don't need to have somebody tell you, well done, or that's really creative, or nice job. No, it's okay for you to know that you had a creative moment and it feels really good.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your estimation, what makes a writer great? What makes great writing?
Gosh. That is such a good question. It's emotion. I mean, it's when I go back to what I know, which is making video and making audio, and the best moments are where you stir someone, right? And I find that with, you know, video and audio, you can do that with a sound or a piece of music or a way you say something. You have much more control, or at least I do. I find it easier for me. And what really wonderful authors, when they can use a word that it's, you know, it's just ink on a page and yet it stirs you in some way, that's a good author, and something I certainly strive to be. I would hope that my second book achieves it more often than the first, but I hope every author feels that way. I'm assuming every author feels that way too.
Are you working on a second?
I want to, yeah. I still like need to get over the first, I think, but I do have, yeah, I have an idea for a second one that I feel like people have been really asking about on the book tour. So yeah, it's daunting though. Now that you know, ignorance is bliss. Once you know what goes into writing a book, you're like, oh shoot, how is that going to happen?
Right. So it's in the incubation phase.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One fun one for you. If you could choose any author from any era for an all expense paid dinner to your favorite spot, who would you take and where would you take them?
That is really tough. This is very difficult. You know who I was, I can think of exactly who it would have been at the age of 21, which was Fowler, the one who wrote The French Lieutenant's Wife and the Magus and Old School British Men was authors. That was my thing for a long time. I read so much nonfiction now that it's hard for me to even think of who that would be. You know who I would like to hang out with? Dude, why is this? I'm like having, you know, Richard Scarry. That's who it's going to be.
Perfect.
Richard Scarry. He's super weird stuff in those books. Like, my kids are obsessed with them. I had them as a child. Yeah. Very, very strange. These German pigs who are eating, like, pigs eating hot dogs while wearing lederhosen. Like, what was going on in this man's mind? Like, my brother bought the URL, What Do People Do All Day? Which is brilliant. And then the Scarry estate called him and asked to buy it. And I don't think they ever did anything with it. But Richard Scarry, What Do People Do All Day? These children's books where, you know, the ones, Pig Yes and Pig No. You remember those?
Of course.
Is this ringing any bells? Okay, good.
Oh, yeah.
Richard Scarry. I want to know what was going through that man's mind.
Love it. Love it. Where would you take him?
Oh, I don't know. Well, where would we go? We'd go to the zoo.
Perfect. For a hot dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, to wrap up here, I will, of course, link to the book, Bored and Brilliant, How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self, based on Minutia's interactive project with tens of thousands of listeners to empower readers to transform their digital anxiety into self-knowledge, autonomy, and action, to unplug from information overload. Love it. I will link to that. And of course, your website, MinushZ.com. Anything else you want to point listeners at before we leave them with one final thought?
Well, you know, I was just thinking, like, I've talked to a lot of writers on the road who are very big fans of things like freedom, like plugins mm-hmm. that keep you off the internet while you're writing. I'm not a fan of that myself. But I would just say, beware of technology to solve your problems with technology. You have the self-knowledge to know what will work for you. And if you claim not to, you're lying. You know what you need to do, and you can do it.
Love it. Perfect way to wrap up. I believe that instinctually. And it's funny because the steps in your book, I think, you know, it's like everybody's probably thought about these things or taken a few steps, but the steps themselves are great. You know, just a guide wire to get you a little further towards being more creative and more
productive.
And
that's interesting that you say that, because that's exactly what people say. Like, I knew that I needed to do these things, but you laying it out specifically and for a very short amount of time made it possible to give it a try. And I think that that's what people need, is they need permission to make a change to some of their creative habits and reasons why, right? We want proof, we want data, we want science. And so no excuses.
For sure. Well, of course, I will link to the podcast, a fantastic show. I'm a big fan. Note to self.
Thanks.
And your TED Talk, I forgot to mention, How Boredom Can Lead to Your Most Brilliant Ideas. I know you talk about it on your show. And it is a fantastic TED Talk. It's got over like 1.3 million views or something like that. But I will link to that also.
That was terrifying. We can talk about that next time.
Okay. Hey, please come back. And thank you so much for...
Oh, super fun, Kelton. Thank you so much for having me on. And we'll be sure to let all of our listeners know too. We'll link to it in the newsletter and push people your way, because I know I'm sure we have some interesting demographic crossovers. So that'd be great.
Thank you. It was
cool,
a pleasure.
Yeah. Our pleasure. Awesome. This was super fun.
Thanks so much for joining me on another tour of the writer's process. If you enjoy the Writer Files podcast, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating or review to help other writers find us. For more episodes or to leave a comment or a question, you can drop by writerfiles.fm, and you can always chat with me on Twitter @KeltonReed. Cheers. Talk to you soon.